Here we are with another exciting episode of Introduction to Paleobiology and the Fossil Record by Benton and Harper.
I'm not going to read this whole thing in that voice, good lord. This is Chapter 5, Macroevolution and the Tree of Life. Key points. Evolution by natural selection is a core scientific model that was set out by Darwin and has been confirmed again and again in every branch of biology. Creationist attempts to promote their religious beliefs, such as intelligent design or a belief in flat earth, are not testable and therefore are not science. Speciation often occurs by the establishment of a barrier and the isolation of part of a previously interbreeding population. Evolution takes place both within species lineages, phyletic gradualism, and at the time of speciation, punctuated equilibrium. The first model is commonest among asexual microorganisms that live in open oceans, and the latter in sexual organisms that are subject to environmental and geographic barriers. There may be a process of species selection acting independently of natural selection, but examples have been hard to find. The evolution of life may be represented by a single branching phylogenetic tree. Cladistics is a method of reconstructing phylogeny based on the identification of shared derived characters, or homologies. Molecular sequencing provides additional evidence for reconstructing and dating the tree of life. DNA has been extracted from fossils such as woolly mammoths, but not from truly ancient fossils. Quote, probably all organic beings which have ever lived on this earth have descended from one primordial form into which life was first breathed. There is grandeur in this view of life, that whilst the planet has gone cycling on, according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms of most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved. Charles Darwin, 1859, On the Origin of Species. Darwin laid the framework for evolutionary biology 150 years ago. Despite millions of essays, books, and websites discussing evolution, no one has yet falsified Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection, and so it stands as the core of modern biology and paleontology, just as Isaac Newton's laws stand at the heart of much of modern physics. And yet, surprisingly, Darwin is quoted and misquoted by many special interest groups who want to use him in support of or against their views on politics, sociology, and religion. So it is important to understand what Darwin said, how his insight affects science today, and how paleontology relies on modern evolution at its basis. Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species, 1859, is usually remembered as the book that made the case for natural selection as the mechanism of evolution, sometimes called, quote, survival of the fittest, unquote. Since the time of Darwin, evolution has been seen in action in the laboratory and in the field, and paleontologists use the principles of evolution to understand how species originate. The origin of species is also core to a second theme in Darwin's writings, namely phylogeny, or the pattern of evolution that is often represented as a branching tree diagram. Darwin's idea was that life had diversified into millions of species by the continued splitting of species from one common stem. Indeed, he proposed that all life, modern and ancient, could be followed back down the phylogenetic tree to a single point of origin. Modern evidence confirms this remarkable insight. Darwin's branching diagram also explained, for the very first time, the meaning of natural hierarchy of life, the meaning of the natural hierarchy of life that Linnaeus had discovered 100 years earlier. Box 5.1, naming, describing, and classifying fossils. Life is organized into an inclusive hierarchy. Small things, species, fit into larger categories, and these fit into still larger categories. Early naturalists realized that it was commonplace to be able to identify broad groups, such as wasps, bats, lizards, grasses, or snails, and that within each group there were many different forms, called species. Life did not consist of a random array of species. The similarity of groups of species suggested two things. First, that a classification system could be drawn up so people could identify and discuss particular forms without confusion. And second, that perhaps the inclusive hierarchy meant something. Taxonomy is the study of morphology and relationships of organisms. Systematics is the broader science of taxonomy and the evolutionary processes, while reclassification refers particularly to the business of naming organisms and identifying the natural hierarchy. When a fossil is described for the first time, the author must name it. Biologists and paleontologists use a modified version of the principles established by the Swedish naturalist and scientist Carl Gustav Linnaeus, 1707 to 1778, often regarded as the founder of systematics. Linnaeus believed that the evident hierarchical order in nature reflected the mind of God. Others at the time were to see things very differently, and to speculate about the possibility of evolution or change through time. In Linnaean nomenclature, a species is given a genus and a species name, such as Homo sapiens. These names are based on words from ancient Latin and Greek, and they are printed in italics, followed by the author's name and date of publication. If, subsequently, another scientist moves a named species to another genus, perhaps because of new observations of similarity, the original author and date must then be placed in parentheses. Where several named species turn out to have been the same, subsequent names are identified as synonyms or aliases of the first name to have been given to the form. When a new species is established, a type specimen is designated, and it is housed in a major institution, such as a museum or a university, accessible to future investigators. The new species is defined by a short diagnosis, a few lines emphasizing the distinctive and distinguishing features of the fossil. A fuller description supported by paragraphs, drawings, and measurements is also given, together with information on geographic and stratigraphic distribution. Fossils, like animals and plants that are alive today, are classified in a hierarchical system, where species are included in genera in families, and all the way up through orders, classes, phyla, kingdoms, and domains. End box. Indeed, Darwin proposed that all life, modern and ancient... Oh, I already said that. Darwin's branching diagram also explained for the first time the meaning of the natural hierarchy of life that Linnaeus had discovered 100 years earlier. This natural, inclusive branching hierarchy is the basis of modern approaches to discovering the tree of life, the single great evolutionary tree that links all species, living and extinct, from the modern biodiversity of over 10 million species back to a single hypothetical species 3,500 million years ago in the Precambrian. Paleontological aspects of evolution, such as the tree of life and studies of processes over thousands and millions of years, are sometimes called macroevolution, quote, big evolution, unquote, to distinguish them from microevolution, quote, small evolution, unquote. All the smaller scale and shorter term processes studied by biologists and geneticists in the laboratory or the field. Evolution by natural selection. The night of September 28, 1838, was important for Darwin. It was then that he realized the missing piece of the evolutionary puzzle, natural selection. He wrote in his autobiography, Darwin, 1859, that, quote, I happened to read for amusement Malthus on population, and being well prepared to appreciate the struggle for the existence which everywhere goes from long-continued observation of the habits of animals and plants, it at once struck me that under these circumstances, favorable variations would tend to be preserved and unfavorable ones destroyed. Unquote. On that date, he drew a simple branching evolutionary tree in his notebook, and a more elaborate version was the only illustration in The Origin. Darwin came to his flash of inspiration by a combination of thoughts and observations. He had seen the huge diversity of life during a five-year-long circumnavigation of the world aboard the Beagle, a British surveying ship. He asked himself why life was so diverse. Every island he visited had different plants and birds. He had seen evidence for relationships in time and space. In South America, he saw the bones of giant extinct ground sloths and armadillos, obviously close relatives of living forms. And as he went from island to island in the Galapagos and elsewhere, he saw close similarities between species of plants, reptiles, and birds. He was aware of the record of fossils in the rocks and that the fossils changed through time and seemed to progress from simple forms in the oldest rocks towards modern forms in the Pliocene and Pleistocene. Thomas Malthus argued in his book, An Essay on the Principle of Population, 1798, that human populations tend to grow far faster than their food supply, and Darwin transferred this concept to the natural world, seeing that reproductive rates are higher than they need to be. Thus, by September 1838, Darwin understood the concept of evolution, a view that had been expressed by many thinkers before, but and that claimed that life had not been static forever, but that species had changed and never stopped changing. He had a rich understanding of modern geographic variation. Why, he asked, does every island in the Galapagos archipelago have a different set of species of small birds, when the same set would do perfectly well throughout? Further, why did the bird species on neighboring islands look more similar to each other than to those on distant islands? So, Darwin's first key insight was that life is more diverse than it ought to be if it had been created, and his second was that all species living and extinct can be linked in a single great evolutionary tree that shows their relationships and that tracks back to a single ancestor. These are descriptive observations of pattern. But Darwin is remembered most for his third insight, and this was the principle of natural selection, a process that explains the diversity of life and its branching history of relationships. Only the organisms best adapted to their environment tend to survive and transmit their genetic characteristics in increasing numbers to succeeding generations, while those less adapted tend to be eliminated. Darwin made the case with remorseless logic, and this can be dissected into a series of clear statements. 1. Nearly all species produce far more young than can survive to adulthood. Malthus principle. 2. The young that survive tend to be those best adapted to survive. Larger at birth, faster growing, noisier in the nest, faster to escape predation, less disease, etc. 3. Characters are inherited from parent to offspring. So the characters that ensure survival, size, aggressiveness, speed, freedom from disease, etc., will tend to be passed on. 4. These survival characteristics will increase generation by generation. The changes are not inexorable, so cheetahs run fast enough to catch their prey, not at 2,000 kilometers per hour, because they do not have to, and their bodies would also fall to bits if they tried. Each of these observations can be supported by a huge number of observations. For point one, note that most animals and plants produce hundreds, thousands, or millions of offspring. If every melon seed grew into a melon plant, or every cod egg became an adult, melons and codfish would soon cover the surface of the earth to a depth of hundreds of meters. For point two, observe any litter of puppies or nest of fledgling birds, and you will see how siblings compete with each other for their parents' attention. For point three, observe your parents or children and see the evidence for inherited characters. For point four, consider how this emerges from points one through three. Evolution by natural selection is on the one hand simple, but also rather complex, and it is frequently misunderstood or misrepresented. Box 5.2, The Foolishness of Intelligent Design. Since the earliest days, philosophers have sought to understand the world and where it came from. At one time, many scholars argued that the Earth was flat, while others argued that Earth was static in space, and the sun and planets rotated around the Earth. These views were famously disproven and rejected some 500 years ago. Most religions have also espoused so-called, quote, creation myths, unquote, often fanciful stories about how the Earth was created and how it was populated with life. One of the most famous creation myths is the Bible story in Genesis of how God created the first man, Adam, and then the first woman, Eve. For some time, religious fundamentalists, people who believe in the literal truth of every word of the Bible, the Quran, or any other religious text, have conducted a campaign against evolution, and often against science and the modern world in general. At present, we see a rise in Christian and Islamic fundamentalism in different parts of the world, and enthusiasts from both religions try to use the political system and the press, and sometimes even violence, to impose their view on others. Creationism is a belief that the earth and life were created, perhaps 7,000 years ago, and that all the areas of science that refer to long timescales, e.g. geology, astronomy, cosmology, and to evolution, all biological and medical sciences, are wrong, and has been particularly prevalent in the United States. After years of ridicule by scientists, creationism has been restyled as intelligent design, the view that organisms are so complex that they must have been created by an intelligent being. Proponents of intelligent design range in their beliefs from the hard line, everything you see around you is exactly as it was created, and creation was only a few thousand years ago, to the liberal. key large groups of plants and animals were created, but perhaps a very long time ago, and perhaps there is some evolution between species. The different branches of creationism, including intelligent design, lack testable hypotheses, and they lack evidence, so they are not credible alternatives to evolution. As an example, many supporters of intelligent design use the flagellum of bacteria as evidence. The flagellum, plural flagella, is a thin structure that beats in a whip-like way to move the bacterium through the fluid in which it lives. The flagellum is composed of several components, and it is normally driven by a proton pump, the flow of hydrogen ions across a concentration gradient. Supporters of intelligent design have chosen the flagellum as a key piece of evidence that biological structures are so complex they could not have evolved, but must have been created whole. They argue that the flagellum is a good example of irreducible complexity, meaning that it can only function as a whole, and that if any part is removed, it fails to function. In fact, this is not true, as has been shown repeatedly, and each component of the flagellum has other functions. So irreducible complexity, the keystone of intelligent design, has not been demonstrated, and it probably reflects a failure of imagination on the part of the investigator. That's sparse. But I suppose this isn't a book on young earth creationism and science and the relationship between the two, if any. Sigh. Darwin's Origin, 1859, said it all, and he said it so well. In conclusion of this section, Darwin described natural selection in action. Quote, "It may be said that natural selection is daily and hourly scrutinizing throughout the whole world every variation, even the slightest, rejecting that which is bad, preserving and adding up all that is good, silently and insensibly working wherever and whenever opportunity offers at the improvement of each organic being in relation to its organic and inorganic conditions of life." Unquote. Interesting that they chose that passage, because he talks about, let's see, the improvement of each organic being in relation to its organic and inorganic conditions of life. I can maybe see where some young earth creationists get the idea that evolution is about one organism turning into a different organism rather than one population of organisms turning into a population of different organisms, if Darwin worded it that way originally. Anyway, that's way off topic. Evolution and the fossil record. Speciation. Species consist of many highly variable individuals, often divided into geographically restricted populations and races. All human beings belong to a single species, Homo sapiens, and yet every person is different. The range of genetic and physical variation among humans is enormous, and much of it appears to be associated with geographic distribution. There has also been variation through time, with the subspecies of Homo sapiens, like H.S. Neanderthalensis, the Neanderthals being stocky and heavily built, possible adaptations to the cold ice age conditions of Europe 30,000 years ago. All species show geographic variation and, where the fossil record is good enough, variation in time as well. So what is a species? The commonest definition is the biological species concept that states, quote, "A species consists of all individuals that naturally breed together and that produce viable offspring," unquote. So all modern humans can breed together and produce fertile, viable children, and they therefore all belong to one species. Wolves and domestic dogs are also highly variable in external appearance, and yet they interbreed successfully, and so they all belong to one species, Canis lupus. Domestic dogs belong to the subspecies C.L. familiaris, the European wolf to C.L. lupus, and there are many other subspecies of wolves from other parts of the world. In other cases, the amount of physical variation may seem much less. There are certain species of frogs and birds, for example, that may look identical, but are differentiated by their songs and never interbreed with a frog or bird with a different song. Local populations may be, to a great extent, autonomous, isolated from other populations of the same species, and with a subtly different gene pool, the overall array of genetic material in all the individuals within a population. The cohesion of a species is maintained over its natural range by processes of gene flow, the occasional wandering of individuals from one area to another, which interbreed with the members of neighboring populations. These processes can be thought of as occurring on many different scales, ranging from the whole Earth for humans to a tiny patch of forest for some insect species. A species can show considerable or little physical variation, and they can be held together by gene flow. How do they split? The process of splitting of a population to form two species is speciation, and there are many models. The most convincing is the allopatric, quote, other homeland, unquote, or geographic model that was proposed in the 1940s by Ernst Mayr, based on the establishment of geographic barriers. He suggested that populations could split and gene flow be prevented by a barrier, such as a new strip of water, a new mountain chain, or even the building of a major road, anything that stops free genetic mixing amongst populations. The separated populations would then diverge for two reasons. One, each population or set of populations would start out with a different gene pool, simply because of the former genetic range of the intact species has now been separated off. And two, selection pressures would be different, perhaps only subtly, on either side of the barrier. The separation can cause a divergence in genotype, the genetic composition of an individual population or species, and phenotype, the external experience. Appearance. The allopatric model of speciation may take two main forms. The process may be symmetric, which, with the ancestral species being divided roughly down the middle of its geographic range, and the two daughter species starting out with similar-sized populations. More dramatic effects may be seen when the split is asymmetric. Here, a small population, perhaps isolated on an island, evolves independently of the parent species, which may continue roughly unchanged. The smaller population may show unusual and rapid evolution because of what Mayr called the founder effect, the fact that its gene pool is a small sample of the overall gene pool, and that new environmental pressures and opportunities may occur. Speciation and evolution in the fossil record. Biologists generally assumed that speciation happens gradually, with both new species branching off from their ancestors slowly. Up to 1970, this view was accepted by most paleontologists, but then everything changed. Eldrich and Gould, 1972, proposed an alternative to the gradual model of evolution, which they termed the punctuated equilibrium model. They argued that the fossil record does not show evolution occurring in species lineages. In fact, they argued, most species lineages show stasis, quote, standing still, unquote, i.e. no change, over long spans of time. Change occurs at the time of speciation. Eldrich and Gould contrasted the two evolutionary models in terms of the shape of a phylogeny. In a phyletic gradualism model, with sloping branches, most evolution takes place within species lineages, and speciation events involve no special additional amount of evolution. Two, in the punctuated equilibrium model, with rectangular branches, almost no evolution takes place within species lineages. They show stasis, and evolution is concentrated in the speciation events that coincide with major sideways shifts. These two models of evolution seem so distinctive, both in the shape of their phylogenies and in their interpretation, that it should be possible to test between them by observations from the fossil record. Testing punctuated equilibrium. Problems. Eldrich and Gould, 1972, argued that many test cases of the pattern of evolution at the species level could be studied from the fossil record. These should have the following features. 1. Abundant specimens. 2. Fossils with living representatives, so that species can be identified clearly. 3. Information on geographic variation, so that rapid speciation events, punctuations, could be distinguished from migrations in or out of the area. 4. Good stratigraphic control, in terms of long continuous sequences of rocks without gaps, abundant fossils throughout, and good dating. The problems in testing became evident early on, because sampling was generally not extensive enough. Williamson, 1981, attempted to counter this problem in one of the most enormous sampling exercises ever. He studied hundreds of thousands of specimens of snails and bivalves in sediments deposited in the Lake Turkana area of Kenya from 1.3 to 4.5 million years ago. Lake Turkana lies in the East African Rift Valley on a tectonically active line where the continent of Africa is unzipping to form two major plates. Lake muds and sands accumulated in thick deposits as the rift opened, and volcanic ash, tuff, beds occur sporadically throughout the sequence. Williamson recorded changes in 19 species lineages and found that stasis was the normal state of affairs, but that rapid morphological shifts had taken place three times, two of which corresponded to substantial lake level rises. He interpreted this as evidence for the punctuated equilibrium model, arguing that rapid environmental changes had caused evolutionary shifts and speciation events. The new species were short-lived, he argued, because the parental shock had survived in neighboring unstressed lakes and returned to colonize Lake Turkana after the lake level changes had taken place. However, even this enormous study aroused controversy. Critics pointed out that the sequence of sediments was not complete enough to be sure that all fossils had been found. There were gaps of 1,000 years or more, and a great deal of gradual evolution could have taken place in that time. Second, Williamson's critics noted that the environmental stress of lake-level change induced only short-term changes in shell shape, and that when the stress was over, the shell shapes apparently reverted to normal. Hence, they proposed that speciation had not taken place, and that the shells had merely changed shape ecophenotypically. This means that the changes happened during the animal's lifetimes, in response to particular stresses as they grew in size, and these changes were not genetically coded, and hence not evolutionary. Most recently, in a thorough restudy of this work, Bert van Boxlayer and colleagues, 2008, have suggested that Williamson got it wrong. They studied mollusks from several of the African Great Lakes, revised the taxonomy, and argue strongly that the three apparent speciation shifts are invasion events, when flooding episodes allowed bivalves and gastropods to enter the lakes from nearby rivers. As water levels subsided, the faunas returned to more or less their pre-flooding condition. So, they argue, this classic example of punctuated equilibrium might be better interpreted as an example of repeated climate change and migration. The new study casts serious doubt on a classic case of supposed punctuated equilibrium, but does not, of course, reject the whole concept. Consensus on speciation in the fossil record. This debate might have led paleontologists to despair of ever finding a convincing case to assess the two models of species evolution. Now, after more than 30 years of debate and hundreds of case studies, there seems to be a consensus. Benton and Pearson, 2001. Interesting that the author of this book would argue for a consensus that he wrote. Am I being too cynical? Perhaps. Both modes of evolution happen in different situations, punctuated equilibrium, particularly among sexually reproducing species that live in ever-changing environments where barriers may be established, and phyletic gradualism is seen among asexual organisms, such as microorganisms that live in the surface waters of the oceans where evolution is slow and barriers non-existent. So it seems that Williamson, 1981, mistook migrations for punctuations, but doubtless his snails were evolving by a punctuated speciation, punctuational speciation, had the evidence been clearer. The fossil record demonstrates the widespread occurrence of stasis. In a review by Irwin and Ansi, 1995, of 58 published studies on speciation patterns in the fossil record, with organisms ranging from Radiolaria to Foraminifera to ammonites and to mammals, and stratigraphic ages ranging from the Cambrian to the Neogene, 41, that is 71%, showed stasis, associated either with gradualism, 15 cases, 37%, or with punctuated patterns, 26 cases, 63%. It seems clear, then, that stasis is common, and that had not been predicted from modern genetic studies. Microfossil groups, such as the single-celled Foraminifera, Radiolaria, and diatoms, commonly show gradual patterns of evolution and speciation. The microscopic skeletons of pelagic open ocean plankton can often be recovered in large numbers from sedimentary deposits that can be shown to have accumulated continuously over vast periods of time. A study by Sorhanis and colleagues in 1998 on the diatom Rhizocyllinia is probably the most detailed recent work on speciation in planktonic organisms. Box 5.3, Gradual Speciation in Radiolarians. Rhizocyllinia is a planktonic diatom that occurs today in huge abundance in the highly productive waters of the equatorial Pacific. The siliceous valves of this genus rain on to the seafloor, where they accumulate in thick piles mixed with other types of sediment. The morphological evolution of Rhizocelenia can be traced by sampling cores of this sediment, which have been taken in several places in the equatorial current system. Relative depths within each core provide a relative chronology, and this chronology can be tied to an absolute age scale using magnetic field reversals in the sediment. Ulf Sorn-Hannes and colleagues from the University of Pennsylvania used this technique to study several million years' worth of evolution in Rhizocelenia, which encompasses a well-marked speciation event. The valves of Rhizocelenia are conical in shape, terminating in an apical process that is rooted in a structure known as the hyaline area. The valves are usually broken at their distal ends, but Sorn-Hannes and his colleagues were able to measure three distinct biometric variables: the length of the apical process, the height of the hyaline area, and the width of the valve at an arbitrary 8, is that picometers, from its apex. The first two characters are related to the overall size of the valve. The third is a shape parameter related to both size and the conical angle of the valve. These measurements, conducted on 5,000 specimens in a number of populations in 8 different cores, spanning 2 million years of evolution and about 60 degrees of longitude. Planktonic diatoms reproduce generally asexually, but like many predominantly asexual organisms, they occasionally produce sexual offspring, probably to counteract the buildup of deleterious mutations. This sexual production means that large populations of Rhizocelenia can be considered as biological species, and speciation must be affected by a permanent barrier to production, reproduction. The morphometric data provide convincing evidence that speciation occurred at or before about 3 million years. Prior to this, there is only one discernible population, but afterwards, two morphologically distinct populations occur, within which there is a range of intergrading variation, but between which there is no morphological gap. The distinction is visible on all three measured parameters. The descendant species are Preibergonii, that later invaded the Indian Ocean, where it appears abruptly in the sediment record. That's pretty cool. End box. In this case, speciation is evidently sympatric, happening on the same spot, because the same splitting event is seen in most of the rock cores from around the equatorial belt of the Pacific. There is no evidence of an invasion of one species from an isolated population elsewhere. Indeed, it is difficult to imagine where that population might have hidden and yet remain viable. Second, it is clear that most morphological evolution was not associated with speciation but occurred afterwards, over about 500,000 years after the morphological distinction first becomes visible. Third, one of the new biological species evolved more rapidly than the other, becoming gradually smaller and evolving a markedly diminished hyaline area, whereas the other retained a morphology more like the ancestral species. Finally, the two species must have evolved slightly differently, different environmental tolerances, for although their geographic ranges overlap for all of their evolution, one of the two daughter species is entirely absent in one of the cores. Sympatric speciation and gradual evolution are probably rarer among marine invertebrates and continental vertebrates, where there are many more possibilities for establishment of physical barriers to interbreeding. Studies of lineage evolution among marine invertebrates from shallow waters suggest punctuated patterns of speciation. Such studies are much harder to make than those of deep-sea microfossils because the continental shelf sediments accumulate sporadically and thus makes it harder to acquire information with high sampling precision. Nonetheless, immensely detailed studies have been carried out. For example, in long-term studies, Alan Cheatham and Jeremy Jackson of the Smithsonian Institution have sampled various genera of bryozoans in the past 10 million years of sediments in the Caribbean, and their studies suggest punctuated patterns of speciation. Box 5.4, punctuated speciation in bryozoans. Oh boy, here we go. Metrorhabditos is an ascophorin chylostome bryozoan. Wow, that is represented today in the Caribbean by three species. Coastal docks on Dominica and other islands in the past 10 million years. Rocks. That makes more sense than docks. Coastal rocks on Dominica and other islands document the past 10 million years of sedimentation in shallow seas. Wow. And they yield abundant fossils of this bryozoan. The fossils show that Metrorabrabadotos. It's going to be real fun when I get to the chapters on marine invertebrates. Radiated dramatically from 8 to 4 million years ago, splitting into some 12 species, most of which then died out by the Quaternary. Studies by Cheatham and Jackson have also established a variety of protocols for distinguishing species within Metrorabdadotepsmi, taking into account the genetics of related extant species and their amount of morphological differentiation, and then extending comparable statistical tests of morphological differentiation to fossil forms. They demonstrated highly significant correlations between genetic and morphometric differences among the modern forms. Based on 46 morphometric characters, the authors established a mechanism for distinguishing lineages among fossils. Lineage splitting in Metrorabdodos, oh god, seems to have been rapid and punctuational in character. Speciation was especially rapid in the interval from 8 to 7 million years ago, with 9 new species appearing. There is some question about sampling quality here, since sampling is poor in the preceding interval, and so some of these 9 species might have appeared earlier. However, the interval from 8 to 4 million years, represented largely by information from Dominica, have been intensely sampled. DSI, Dominican Sampling Interval. So, although there are questions over the origins of the 9 basal species within this interval, the origins of the remainder are more confidently documented as punctuated. The same kind of punctuated pattern of speciation has been found also in virtually all other studies on fossil marine invertebrates that have been carried out. All right, Benton, you're starting to sell me. On the your 2001, it looks like, argument of a consensus. All right, fine. I guess I should have read it before criticizing it. End box. Current evidence suggests that Eldridge and Gould, 1972, were right to challenge the assumption that evolution always had to be slow and gradual. In some cases, it seems clear that species can split off rather rapidly, and that it is entirely consistent with Darwinian evolution. Paleontological studies have shown that species often remain unchanged for long periods, the new phenomenon of stasis that had not been predicted from genetics. Asexual planktonic microorganisms appear to speciate slowly, perhaps over intervals of 0.5 to 1 million years in a gradualistic way, and sexually reproducing animals that occupy divided and complex habitats perhaps tend to speciate rapidly in a punctuated manner. Species selection. Stephen Stanley, 1975, argued that a punctuational model of evolution could imply a different kind of process, termed by him species selection, that occurred at the same time as, but separate from, natural selection. Stanley envisaged a process that sorted species and might diversify and ensured that some parts of the tree of life might diversify rapidly and others more slowly. He emphasized that if there was such a process as species evolution, then the species-level characters must be distinct from the individual-level characters involved in natural selection. It is not enough to say, for example, that among large African cats, lions might survive certain kinds of competitive situations because they are larger than the other hunters. Being large is an individual-level character, and selection for size is through natural selection. Species-level characters, then, must be irreducible to the individual level. Possible species-level characters include the size of the geographic range of a species, the pattern of populations within overall species range, characteristic levels of gene flow among population of a species, and average species durations. Some studies have suggested that species-level characters of these kinds may play a part in evolution. Geographically widespread species of gastropods, for example, tend to have longer durations than more localized species, and hence can be said to survive longer because of a species-level character. If a species selection is a real force in evolution, then Darwinian evolution would have to be expanded to incorporate a hierarchy or multi-level array of processes. Wow, I can't wait to see what the figure illustrations for that will look like. A possible resolution of this issue is the effect hypothesis of Verba, there's no vowel, 1984, She argued that some species-level characters may be reducible indirectly to the individual level. That is to say, a broadly based feature of a species actually depends on some character that is under the influence of natural selection. She gave an example from her own work on the evolution of antelope over the past 6 million years. About 5 million years ago, antelopes branched into two groups, one consisting of long-lived species that never became diverse, and the other of shorter-lived species that radiated widely. Species duration in the first group was 2 to 3 million years, and total species diversity through the Pliopleistocene was 2. In the second group, species duration was 0.25 to 3 million years, and 32 species evolved. Surely here, she argued, species selection was taking place. The character of short species duration in the second group permitted great success, as measured by overall species diversity. Verba noted, however, that the long-lived antelope and had wide ecological preferences, while those in the second group were specialists. Hence, the whole pattern could be explained by natural selection at the level of individual antelope, where their ecological tolerances determine their evolutionary rates and produce a superficial appearance of species selection. Is evolution hierarchical? And if so, was Darwin wrong? The case has been overstated by critics. Evolution occurs by natural selection, as Darwin said in 1859. Many proposed examples of species selection can be explained by natural selection, coupled with rapid asymmetric geographic speciation and the effect hypothesis. Nonetheless, species selection is a possibility, and convincing examples may be found in the future. The Tree of Life. Tree thinking. As noted at the start of this chapter, Darwin was the first to picture evolution as a great branching tree and to point out that all species had evolved from a single ancestor at the base of the tree. The idea of the Tree of Life has come to the fore recently, with massive efforts by biologists and paleontologists to discover the whole tree. From small-scale questions like which species of ape is closest to humans, the gorilla or the chimp, large teams of researchers are hastening to put together complete trees of all species of mammals, angiosperms, amphibians, spiders, and many other groups. As each complete tree, that is, a tree containing all species, is published, systematists are getting closer to Darwin's ideal of understanding the shape of the whole tree of life. It is important to distinguish trees from ladders. Many people think that all plants and animals are arranged in a series from simple to complex, or lower to higher. The pattern of evolution, then, is like a ladder, a single long line of progression from one species to the next, an ideal that was popular 200 years ago and termed the Scala Naturae. But all the evidence shows that evolution is a process of splitting, and so the tree is the correct analogy, not the ladder. Fossils offer fundamental information on the history of life and on large-scale patterns of evolution. There has been a revolution in the ways in which paleontologists interpret evolutionary aspects of the fossil record, and this is true of biologists as well. Nearly all studies of ecology, behavior, and evolution are tied to a phylogenetic tree of the organisms involved. Since 1990, phylogenetic trees have been springing up everywhere, both because of new techniques for discovering the trees and a realization that nothing in biology means anything without a tree. Cladistics, reconstructing life's hierarchy. For centuries, biologists have struggled with the search for the true pattern of relationships among organisms. How is the tree of life to be discovered? Debates about whether birds originated from dinosaurs, whether annelids and arthropods are close relatives or not, or whether the gorilla or the chimp is the closest relative of human species, all hinge on the need to identify patterns of relationships correctly. If you had the task of sorting out the relationships among 100 species of parrots, where would you begin? You might note the color of their feathers and classify them into a blue group, a red group, and a green group. But then you might notice that body size or beak shape gives a different classification. If you then looked at the internal anatomy of the 100 parrots, you might find an entirely different classification based on the shape of the skull, the bones of the wing, or the arrangement of muscles and arteries. Up to 1960, systematists had a hard task in seeking to decide which characters were, quote, good and which were, quote, bad. good characters are phylogenetically informative. That is, they're indicative of the true phylogeny. But what about the bad or uninformative characters? Phylogenetically uninformative characters fall into two main categories: convergences and plesiomorphies. Convergence, in evolution, is when features or organisms evolve to look the same way, perhaps because they live the same way. The marsupial mole of Australia looks just like the Northern Hemisphere mole, with great paddle-like limbs, poor eyesight, and an excellent sense of smell, because they are both burrowers and eat worms, and yet they are not closely related. Two species of parrots might have convergently evolved a red patch of feathers on their wings as a signal. Plesiomorphies are characters that are shared by the organisms of interest, say parrots, but also by other groups. So all parrots have beaks, but this isn't really a helpful character in sorting out the phylogeny of parrots because all other birds have beaks too. True parrots have blue and green feathers that have a special iridescent quality not seen in the feathers of cockatoos. But such special light-reflecting feathers are also seen in many other bird groups, and so are plesiomorphic for parrots. Phylogenetically informative characters identify clades, or monophyletic, groups. These are groups that had a single origin and include all of the descendants of that common ancestor. A good example of a clade is the cetaciforms, the parrots, a group that has long been identified as real and distinct from others by naturalists. Clades are distinguished from two kinds of non-natural groups. One, paraphyletic groups, which had a single common ancestor but do not include all of the descendants, such as reptilia, which excludes birds and mammals. And two, polyphyletic groups, which are random assemblages of organisms that arose from more than one ancestor, and so have no place in the search for the tree of life. Willy Hennig, 1913 to 1976, an eminent German entomologist, realized the difference between phylogenetically informative and uninformative characters, and between monophyletic and paraphyletic or polyphyletic groups. He stressed the need to develop a new, more objective method in systematics, which has come to be called cladistics. The fundamental aim of cladistics is to identify clades and so to discover or reconstruct the tree of life. Patterns of relationships are shown as branching diagrams, or cladograms, in which the most closely related species are joined most closely. The branches in the cladogram join at branching points, or nodes, each of which marks the base of a clade. Hennig invented a rather complex terminology for cladistics, but some terms are commonly used and should be mentioned. He calls phylogenetically informative characters apomorphies, or derived characters, and distinguished them from plesiomorphies, the characters present in wider groups. Apomorphies, shared by two or more species, are termed synapomorphies. Apomorphies are features that arose only once in evolution, and therefore diagnose all of the descendants of the first organism to possess that new character. Synapomorphies of parrots, the bird order cetaciformes, include the deep hooked beak and the unusual foot in which two toes point forward and two back. The concept of an apomorphy actually corresponds to an older distinction between homology and analogy in evolution. The forelimb of vertebrates is a good example of homology. Even though the arm of a bird and the arm of a human are very different, the forearm of vertebrates is a good example of homology. Even though the arm of a bird is very different from the... I did it again. Even though the arm of a human is very different from the wing of a bird or the paddle of a whale, there we go, the detailed anatomy of each is the same, and they clearly arose from the same ancestral structure. On the other hand, the swimming limbs of vertebrates differ from group to group. In detail, it can be shown that the paddles of ichthyosaurs, whales, plesiosaurs, and seals are not homologs. They are merely analogs. Cladistics might seem relatively straightforward, but it is not in practice. Box 5.5, Cladistic Analysis. There are three steps in drawing a cladogram: character analysis, outgroup comparison, and tree calculation. The character analysis is the process of listing characters that vary among organisms of interest, and identifying those that are possible apomorphies. Characters are often coded as presence or absence, or 0/1. So, for example, in a character analysis of apes, a possible apomorphy might be possession of an opposable thumb used for gripping. This would be coded as present, or 1, in humans, and absent, or 0, in chimpanzees and gorillas. The outgroup comparison is the phase when characters and their coatings are tested for validity. If the group under study, the in-group, consists of the apes, then the outgroup might be monkeys. The outgroup could really be oak trees and worms, but they are so distantly related to apes that the comparisons would largely be meaningless. Oak trees and worms do not even have thumbs. Comparison with the outgroup of monkeys shows that monkeys, chimpanzees, and gorillas have non-opposable thumbs. So this is coded 0, and the opposable thumb of humans appears to be unique, an apomorphy, and so is coded 1. The final step is tree calculation. All of the characters and their codings are listed in a data matrix, a tabulation of the data, listing all the species and all the characters in their codings. The tree calculation is usually run by computer, and a search is carried out using different methods to find the single tree or group of trees that best explain the data. We give a simple worked example here to determine the relationships of 6 vertebrates: shark, salmon, frog, lizard, chicken, and mouse. These are distant relatives, of course, representing cartilaginous fishes, bony fishes, amphibians, reptiles, birds, and mammals, respectively, but if we can sort out their relationships, we have a broad outline of the phylogenetic tree of all vertebrates. 10 out of many characters are listed in the data matrix below, and their codings are shown: 0 equals absent, 1 equals present, for each of the 6 animals. Next, outgroup comparison will help to sort out the phylogenetically informative characters from the plesiomorphies. We will choose 2, and the chicken and mouse are warm-blooded, and the others are cold. Oh, I forgot one. We will choose 2 examples. The shark and the salmon have fins, character 1, while the others have legs, character 2. And the chicken and mouse are warm-blooded, and the others are cold-blooded, character 3. Outgroup comparison of these 2 sets of characters suggests that warm-bloodedness is probably an apomorphy, because most members of the outgroup, such as clams, oak trees, and bugs, are cold-blooded. But it is hard to tell whether fins or legs are apomorphies or not, so these 2 are retained. Scanning over the data in this table, it is clear that some groupings are indicated by several synapomorphies, but there are contradictions. For example, the diapsid skull supports a pairing of lizard and chicken, but warm-bloodedness suggests pairing a chicken and mammal. Both pairings are not possible, and one of these synapomorphies must be wrongly interpreted. The method of testing at this point is to seek the most parsimonious pattern of relationships, that is, the one that explains most of the data and implies least mismatch or incongruence. The data may be run through a computer program, such as PAUP, that finds the most parsimonious cladogram and highlights the incongruent, i.e. probably misinterpreted, characters. The cladogram is, of course, a best effort, and further study of the specimens and the discovery of new characters can confirm or refute it. The cladogram can be made into a phylogeny by the addition of a time scale. Here, fossil evidence for dates of origin of the various groups is used to give a picture of the true shape of this part in the phylogeny of life. Read more about cladistics in Forey et al., 1998, and about cladistics as applied to fossil organisms in Smith, 1994. Cladistics software includes PAUP, Spofford 2007, the most used program, and basic cladistic routines are available in PAST, Hammer and Harper 2005. End box. There are many controversies as systematists try to find agreement on disputed parts of the tree of life. In some cases, the shape of the tree is clear because each node is diagnosed by many apomorphies, but in others, the clades and nodes are hard to pinpoint. Perhaps in those cases, evolution happened so fast that the apomorphies were not established, or perhaps they have been overwritten in time. The molecular revolution. The second approach in reconstructing the tree of life is based on comparison of molecules. With the birth of molecular biology in the 1500s, birth of molecular biology, the 1950s and the 1960s, it became clear that homologous proteins share similar structures in different organisms. For example, many animals share the molecule hemoglobin, a protein that carries oxygen in the blood and that makes blood red. Structurally, the hemoglobin of all organisms that possess it is very similar because it has to perform its oxygen-carrying function. But there are subtle differences. The hemoglobin of humans and chimps is identical, but their hemoglobin differs a little from that of a horse or cow, and a great deal from the hemoglobin of a shark or salmon. Comparisons of molecules allow analysts to do 2 things: to draw up trees of relationships and to estimate time. trees of relationships can be based on a simple comparison of the amount of difference between protein sequences, and a best-fitting dendrogram or branching diagram is drawn. Identifying specific amino acid changes and treating them as synapomorphies allows the dendrogram to be treated as a molecular cladogram. Time estimation comes from the concept of the molecular clock. The amount of difference in the fine structure of a protein between any pair of species is proportional to the time since they last shared a common ancestor. Differences have been documented in the primary structure of proteins, the sequence of amino acids from end to end of the unfurled protein backbone. There are some 20 amino acids, and their sequence determines the shape and function of a protein. Small changes in the amino acid sequence of hemoglobin occurred every few million years, somewhat at random, and the rate of change allows a timescale to be calibrated against the molecular tree. Since 1990, attention has shifted almost entirely from sequencing proteins to sequencing the nucleic acids such as DNA and RNA. These are the molecules in the nucleus that comprise the genetic code, and they may be sequenced in a semi-automated manner using a process called the polymerase chain reaction, PCR. PCR is a means of cloning or duplicating small samples of nucleic acid and then determining the exact sequence of base pairs, the four components of the nucleic acid strand, adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine, or uracil, abbreviated as A, C, G, and T, or U. DNA and RNA may be sequenced from the nucleus or the mitochondria of cells, and molecular biologists generate huge sequences of information every year. Indeed, the Human Genome Project was one of the many examples of international programs to determine the entire DNA sequence of all the chromosomes of a single species. The PCR method has also opened up the possibility of sequencing the genetic material of extinct organisms. Box 5.6. Fossil proteins, the real Jurassic Park? Proteins were extracted from fossils in the 1960s and 1970s, but most of these were decay materials, the proteins of bacteria that decomposed the original tissues. Even in the case of exceptional preservation where soft tissues are preserved, the proteins have usually long vanished. Until 1985, the oldest DNA recovered in tiny quantities came from Egyptian mummies, 24,000 years old. Sorry, 2,400 years old. Then came Jurassic Park. In the book by Michael Crichton, 1990, and in the film by Steven Spielberg in 1993, a scenario was developed where molecular biologists extracted dinosaur DNA from blood retained in the stomach of a mosquito preserved in amber. The fragments of dinosaur DNA were cloned and inserted into the living cells of a modern frog, an odd choice when the nearest living relatives of dinosaurs are birds, and the whole dinosaur genetic code was somehow reconstructed, and living dinosaurs were created. Amazingly, science then followed the fiction for a time. Michael Crichton was wise to choose amber as the means of preservation. Insects in amber are trapped instantly, usually overwhelmed by the sticky resin, and no decay takes place. The amber excludes oxygen and water so that no physical or chemical changes should occur during the subsequent millennia. A series of scientific reports were published in high-profile journals through the 1990s, announcing original DNA from a termite in Oligocene-Miocene amber, a weevil in early Cretaceous amber, Miocene leaves, and even a supposed dinosaur DNA in 1994. These reports collapsed like a pack of cards soon after. The, quote, dinosaur DNA turned out to be a human. The PCR technique is so sensitive that the tiniest fragment of DNA, in this case sweat or sneezed mucus of a lab assistant, can be amplified. Careful study showed that DNA is highly labile and breaks down in even hundreds of years, and is pretty well all gone by 40,000 years, even in the most exceptional preservation. The most convincing studies of DNA fossil species came from Ice Age mammals such as the cave bear, the giant Irish deer, Neanderthal man, woolly rhino, and woolly mammoth. In a rush of enthusiasm, three labs independently sequenced and published the complete mitochondrial genome of the woolly mammoth in early 2006. The studies gave conflicting results. It is still not clear whether the closest living relative of the mammoth is the Asian elephant, Elephas maximus, or the African elephant, Loxodonta africana. All studies, though, confirm that modern elephants and the mammoth are about as closely related to each other as humans are to chimps, and that the species split apart about 5 to 6 million years ago. and Vox. The vast numbers of DNA and RNA sequences that are generated daily from the whole diversity of life are stored as letter codes in open access databases. Any investigator may download the sequences of any particular gene or chromosome for as many species as are available. There are then two key processes in extracting a phylogenetic tree from such data. First, the nucleic acid sequences must be aligned, that is, matched, so that the code of a particular gene in one species is lined up with the same sequence in another species. Alignment can be difficult because species do not differ only in the placement of particular base pairs, but sometimes gaps in the sequence are introduced or whole sections may be repeated. Once the sequences of a number of species are satisfactorily aligned, the phylogenetic analysis is carried out. The base pair codes are treated like the absence and presence 0/1 codes in a morphological data matrix, and a variety of algorithms are applied to extract the most likely tree that explains the data. The tree of life. Paleontologists and biologists are using morphology and molecules to put together an ever larger sector of the tree of life. Desktop computers are exploding in labs around the world as analysts ask them to crank out ever larger trees. Bear in mind that the number of possible trees is n equals complex math that's very high, that includes 2 exclamation points, which means it's really, really high. So for 3 species, there are 3 possible unique trees. For 4 species, there are 15 possible trees. For 8 species, 168,210 possible trees. And for 50 species, about the same number as there are atoms in the universe. You can do these calculations at this website, blah, blah. And yet 50 species is not a demanding number. Systematists want to know the complete tree for all 240 species of primates, all 4,500 species of mammals, and so on. Mathematicians tinker with tree finding software so that it finds clever ways to find the best fitting tree quickly, even though many millions or billions of potential trees are considered and rejected. Another approach is to link existing trees for parts of the group that of interest to create a super tree that summarizes the information in all existing trees. Researchers are currently using all methods and approaches to draw major sectors of the tree of life, and such huge trees will allow paleontologists and biologists to carry out many novel studies of macroevolution. Review questions. 1. Consider the 4 logical steps that summarize natural selection. List examples for each of the numbers, 1 through 3, and consider how the mechanism could be disproved. 2. Read books and websites that present evidence for intelligent design. Ah, yes, I have done that. Quite a bit. List some specific examples or case studies that are cited by intelligent design supporters and present those in the form of falsifiable scientific hypotheses. Sort of a fun exercise, that. Find 10 paleontological case studies on speciation by searching the internet with the keywords phyletic gradualism and punctuated equilibrium. Look at the original papers and consider how well each one fulfills the 4 criteria for a good study: abundant specimens, fossils with living representatives, information on geographic variation, and good stratigraphic control. Which of the 10 studies that you have chosen is sufficiently well documented to give a meaningful conclusion? How would you design a study to test whether species selection might have happened? Oh, that was number 4, sorry. 5. Construct a cladogram of the apes and identify apomorphies for each node. The likely shape of the tree is gibbon, chimp plus human, closest together, then gorilla, then orangutan, then gibbon. So read around and find the cladistic basis for the tree. Disclaimer, I'm not a young earth creationist. I just really like reading young earth creationist propaganda. I find it fascinating. I don't know whether that's a good thing or not.